The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. The last things that 13-year-old Robert Turner wrote were a suicide note and his will. 13 years of age, and you know what he said in the note he left behind? He had found that life isn't worth living. In that short lifespan, Robert, who was fond of science and chemistry, found that, in his words, life wasn't worth living. And so he attached wires to an electric socket in his lounge and then grounded them outside. Then he wrapped the wires around his leg and electrocuted himself. Now, a few years ago, a young girl, 15, shot and killed herself on her way home from high school, and police termed her death a suicide. Officers said the girl had carried with her all day at school a .22 caliber target pistol owned by her father. Detective Clyde Galano said the girl had been under a doctor's care, and he said a passage written by her in a notebook found beside her body said, "I ask one simple question, what are we here for?" That's a good question, a question that has baffled people for millennia of time. They do not know why we are here, what life is all about. But to a 13-year-old who was able to leave a suicide note, life isn't worth living. And to a 15-year-old girl, their whole lives before them, the entire future stretching out before them, at the very time in life when life should become more interesting, more exciting than ever before, they took their lives. You know that the feeling that life is not worth living occurs to at least 10% of our populaces. 10% of Americans, a Baltimore psychiatrist said, feel life is not worth living. In fact, it's the most challenging problem that confronts the modern physician, said Dr. Frank J. Hyde, Jr., chief of psychiatry at the Franklin Square Hospital in Baltimore. He said that of all the psychiatric ills to which man is heir, depression occurs with the greatest frequency. Now, most of you are depressed, and this is not some kind of a program about a pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstrap philosophy of living of the inner or the better you, or some peace of mind or mind science idea either. But it's about time we began to ask the question, what is life all about, and why are so many of us so terrified with the problems confronting us in this modern dog-eat-dog world of ours today, of the population explosion, of growing pollution, of mounting crime and violence and divorce, of the war in Vietnam and the threat of nuclear bomb war, that more and more people are becoming candidates for suicide. They're living, moving, and having their being in a kind of an empty, meaningless void where their greatest pastime seems to be that of ridiculing their environment, of carping and griping with acidic commentary on the actions of other people, of a lot of hostile truculence toward institutions, people, places, and things. You know, every time I look at British television, I get a little sick in my stomach. Well, of course, I get a little sick in my stomach watching certain TV shows in the United States, too, so I'll say it for both of our people so we can all listen in and enjoy it together. But I can't understand how some people get away with it. You see a comedian, and it's not funny, but a comedian comes on the video tube and begins to ridicule and make fun of, I saw this on a recent visit to Britain, the top church man in the entire nation. Here he is wearing the garb, this comedian, of a churchman. And he's got on a black robe, and he is talking in a high, squeaky voice, and very obviously mimicking, deliberately, over the air, on television, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and belittling the man's office and position. Now, you know, the more you look in newspapers, and especially on the editorial and opinion pages, the more cartoons you see of caricatures of Mr. Johnson, or of the Queen of England, or of the leader of some nation, and the more you see people ridiculing, and some of the records that are really selling today, the various talk records about leading people in prestigious positions in industry, and especially in government, and you see their voices are taken out on tape. Now, I'm talking right now into a microphone, but of course, simultaneously, as you hear it live, it's being taped so it can be sent to other stations around the world. And it's possible, you know, on these tapes to take a little section of it out and to make a person seem to be saying something totally different from what they are saying. So here's some of the real big selling records today of taking comments that Mr. Johnson, Mrs. Johnson, others have said at different times, then asking questions and make them appear to answer those questions in a humorous way. But of course, some of it is not humor. Some of it is deliberately carping and griping against an office, and instead of taking exception or issue with a certain policy, it is taking exception or issue to a person, to a personality. And deliberate defamation of character is indulged in oftentimes today by so many people who are tired of living, who don't seem to have any goal or any purpose in being. They don't know where they're going, and life is kind of an empty void, one meaningless experience after another, and nothing really satisfies them, nothing really makes them happy. Do you know that suicide is the second largest cause of death among college students? Young people who should be discovering the real answers to the big questions that plague everybody. And instead of finding any answers, they're only finding bigger questions and more problems. Now, a study that was made public recently, appearing in the latest issue of The Moderator, a magazine aimed at top-ranking students, also predicted that the number of suicides for the year of 1966 would reach 1,000, with 90,000 students threatening to kill themselves and 1 in 10 actually attempting it. But it was admitted by the magazine that those estimates were very conservative. Now, while suicides among the young have always been higher than many people realize or like to admit, these figures seem to indicate a rising rate among young people in college and of college age. In fact, the suicide rate among college students now seems to be 50% higher than that for the country as a whole. You know, usually you think of suicides as being way down the list of the cause of death for students, and yet it's right next to automobile accidents. It's amazing that the percentages of deaths for students are 37% in accidents and 34% of all student deaths attributed to suicide. That was a report from a study quoting from University of California report. Now, what does it take to cause a 13-year-old to wrap wires around his leg and plug them into the wall? What does it take for a 15-year-old girl to shoot herself on the way home from school? And for these alarming incidences of suicide in so many cases today, and especially among younger people. It simply is this. They do not understand the purpose in life. Life is empty and has no meaning for them. They're frightened by the events of today. They see no future. They have probably come from a wretched environment where they have only experienced carping, griping, nagging, worrying, quarreling, possibly broken homes, but you can't always point to that. Many times a suicide will occur in a home where the kid is supposed to have had everything that is probably, but real love and real concern and real understanding, everything but an understanding of the purpose in life and a goal in living. But here you have people taking their lives, and for all of those who do not take their lives, millions of people's lives are empty and meaningless today. There is no goal. Can you answer the question to this poor kid who said, "Why are we here? That's the only question I want to ask." She blew her brains out with a .22 pistol, but she asked the question in her notebook she left behind, lying there beside her body. "I just want to ask you one question. What are we here for?" Could you have answered her question satisfactorily if she'd still been living to where she wouldn't have blown her brains out with her own pistol? Does the average person know why he is here, where he is going, what life is all about? Do you ever take time to ask yourself those questions? Now, most of us seem convinced we simply can't find the answer to those big questions in life, but you can. And there is a beginning, there is a basic point, a basic place at which you must begin to answer those questions. And it begins with the question, was life created, or did life evolve? You know that life exists in all of its myriad forms, human life, animal life, insect and plant life. This vast, limitless universe of ours, with the one galaxy, or the Milky Way, as we call it, in our solar system, exists. It's real. It's tangible. You can measure it, weigh it. You can observe it. You can watch how it works. You know that forces, laws, and energies are acting upon it. Did every bit of this just occur by chance, by some caprice? Or is it the result of a great design? Is it the result of a plan? Does it have some purpose? Is there some direct outcome, some product involved in the very being of things? One of the greatest faiths on earth today is not really a religious faith. in one sense of the word, you could call it that, but I mean by that, it doesn't talk about God, it's the faith of no God, evolution. And yet, it is a faith. As a matter of fact, the more evolution I read, and the more I study, and the more I see some of the statements of people trying to tell you that birds came from reptiles, the more dumbfounded I am at the naivety and of the incredible faith of some of these people who, while never having seen it, never having any evidence whatsoever, but actually missing billions of tons of cubic evidence, and I mean by that the whole geologic column and record upside down, the proofs of the Noachian deluge all about them, the fossil record is directly contradicting much of what they say, yet in spite of that, having a tenacious faith in nothing, no God, and believing in evolution. Now, let me tell you one of the funniest things that I've read recently on the subject, Kenny Kanapoy. Now, Kenny Kanapoy is an elbow bone. This elbow bone was found in Kenya, and the Cambridge, Massachusetts newspaper, and this was reported in the New York Times, says that this now has proven to science that man is really 2.5 million years of age. Now, I can prove to you that man is practically 6,000 years of age, not quite. I mean, I can prove that to you. You can prove it to yourself. I have booklets on the subject, and of course, anyone who wants to really look into evolution, he'll find the same thing that I have, and he'll find all of the vast areas where evolution is missing all kinds of evidence and is nothing but a real sketchy framework of so much guesswork and dealing with little twiggy notions. But now here's the amazing thing that this newspaper said. A discovery seemed to push the history of man back to 2.5 million years was made public recently by Harvard University. And there was an elbow bone. It had been identified as that of a man-like creature believed to have lived some 750,000 years earlier than Homo habilis, who inhabited the Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, and until now was supposedly the oldest known man-like fossil. Now, this discovery was reported by a group who had been in the area for a long time searching for various fossils, and it was a find that consisted of the lower portion of the upper arm, the humerus bone. It was found one hot August afternoon in 1965. Now, the amazing thing is that finding an elbow bone, they can tell exactly how old it is. This is what we're told to believe. And also, here was the amazing thing, and I quote one of the men who reported on it, quote, since the new find is only an elbow bone, nothing can be said of the creature's way of life except that it walked upright. Now, I think that is very, very exciting. Very interesting. It had an elbow. Well, so do crocodiles. And they don't walk upright. It had an elbow, so it walked upright. But so do many beasts and creatures, but they don't walk upright. And, of course, I've even heard theories that men originally crawled around on all fours. And, of course, all different types of apes and monkeys have elbow bones, and not all of them walk upright. Some of them do, like a chimpanzee, but not all of them. And since it was supposed to be similar to that of a man, it was also similar, incidentally, to the bone of a chimpanzee, if that has any bearing on the subject. The idea was this creature inhabited that area, and it walked upright, and it is 2.5 million years of age. Now, I think that is amazing. What do scientists see when they look at an old bone? An old bone? That's all. They see the same thing that you would see when you look at an old bone. But you don't have an index fossil book, and you don't have any preconceived notions about deliberately trying to find a fossil in an area where you are searching, where you just know that if you find one, it's bound to be about 2.5 million years of age. That's the difference. In the current number of the Plain Truth magazine, and coming along in every number of the Plain Truth, articles on the question of evolution. In the current number, one that asks the question, could it be possible that our modern-day birds evolved from reptiles? And coming along in the next number, another article on the same subject. This is at the very basis of the questions about life, about the purpose in life, and the reason for your drawing breath as to whether or not there is any goal in life, any purpose you ought to be fulfilling, is where did life begin? Where did life come from? And entirely too many people are bamboozled and hoodwinked into believing in a theory that is so empty it is laughable when you look into it, the theory of evolution. There is a statement in the first chapter of the book of Romans in your Bible that says such people are deliberately and willingly ignorant that they have plenty of evidence that the idea of denying God's existence is the beginning hypothesis upon which evolution is based, that an evolutionist must begin by making up his mind there isn't any God. He must decide to believe in advance there is no God, and then go on to try to explain how all of these life forms could have been put on the earth as a result of caprice, an accident. Now, if I told you that a modern jet aircraft evolved, you would think I was insane. If I were to tell you that a cabin grew into a fuselage, the fuselage then grew a tail, a stabilizer, and that it grew then all of the rest of the apparatus that makes the airplane fly, the wings, the ailerons, the elevators, everything, all the control cables, the vast complex instrument, all the electronic gear, the radio units in it, the breaker switches, everything that is in the aircraft, all the instrument and the engine gauges, everything of the kind, it all evolved. You'd say, well, that's kind of silly because that's a man-made, manufactured product. And it took the mind of man. It took a superior intellect. It took creative ability to put together a fantastic machine that weighs more than air to make it fly. But we're talking about birds. Well, evolution says, believe it or not, that millions of years ago, birds, which weren't then birds, but reptiles, reared their slimy, ugly heads from fetid seas and slithered ashore. Maybe you saw the one recently where the snake was slithering by under the snow, and his woman heard it going by and went out and hit it with a club anyhow, and he had a noisy slither. Well, some of these creatures maybe slithered a little noisily as they slithered out of the fetid seas. Then evolution would have you believe that over uncountable aeons of time, these creatures began to climb and to run along limbs of trees. They walked upright. Gradually, they began to grow feathers in various parts of their body. And as time kept passing, they learned, however that occurred, to hover, to glide, to soar, to flitter, to flutter, and even fly backward, because, you know, some birds do, like hummingbirds and the like. Birds came from reptiles, say the evolutionists. As a matter of fact, one book on the subject, you can pick it up. It's a paperback book. It's The Biology of Birds by Wesley Lanyon. You could buy it on most newsstands, I imagine, where they sell paperbacks. Some of the paperbacks now that are a little more educational. And it will tell you under the caption of one picture in that book that it's thought very strange by some people that the closest living relatives of birds are crocodiles. And I have to agree with that statement. That is strange. That's about like saying that butterflies evolved from rhinoceroses or that men evolved from houseflies. It makes just exactly as much sense to me. That birds came from reptiles, that all these thousands of birds, all these myriad of different types of birds that hover, birds that soar, the fantastic albatross, the tiny ruby-throated hummingbird, migratory waterfowl, the Arctic tern that migrates thousands of miles. Here are birds with a completely unique airframe with porous bones, bones that have large hollow centers to them, bones that are completely porous, that have little holes through them that are perfect airframes. Little cross structures in their skeletal framework that makes up a fantastically strong yet lightweight airframe. Now that body, that framework's not going to fly by itself. A bird also has wings, and wings are composed of fantastic muscles and a skeletal framework and a nervous system and so on, but also completely covered with feathers. Now each feather is a miracle all by itself. Every little tiny, well, you could call them barbules, little interlocking members of a feather. It's like a tiny feather within a feather. It's a perfect lightweight airframe, interlocked and connected by thousands of little tongs. It's one of the most intricate things you have ever looked at. And if you want to get your boy or your girl a beginning science set that has a little microscope in it, sometime get a feather of a bird or a chicken and look at it under a microscope. Just study it, and then sit there and ask yourself, how did that evolve? Now, if you have feathers but not the airframe, you can't fly, but there's more to it than that. Birds also have a fantastic metabolism. They have a very rapidly beating heart, but they have all through their body air sacs, and those air sacs act as sort of extra lungs and a cooling system. Air is pumped into those air sacs. They add in buoyancy, but they also add in a cooling system because, you know, birds don't sweat. You see, if birds sweat, their feathers get wet and down they go, so birds don't sweat. But here you have members of the reptile family, not all of whom, but some of whom fairly ooze all kinds of secretions out between their scales and their armor plates and their skin. Reptiles have huge, thick bones, heavy, meaty structures. Many of them, especially the crocodiles, unbelievably slow-moving, slow metabolism, long lives. You know, crocodiles can even digest belt buckles. But crocodiles don't have gizzards. Crocodiles have fantastic acids in their stomachs where they've eaten men and even managed to digest their belt buckles. Crocodiles have been shot and their stomachs opened up along Lake Victoria and other places in Africa where they have found various bits of metal that were almost totally eroded away inside their stomachs. Birds, well, they have to have a diet that is just so. A tremendously complex, by the way, high-protein, high-energy diet. Take a bee. He eats his own honey, because he gets a tremendous energy source from it. Any way you want to look at it, when you really investigate birds, as these articles do in the Plain Truth magazine, and look at it carefully, technically, scientifically, logically, it just doesn't make sense, and there is no proof for it. Now, this first article takes exception to this idea of Archaeopteryx, which means ancient wing, because this is supposed to be the link between birds and lizards. And the story goes, imagine a strange bird-like creature the size of a crow gliding over an ancient Bavarian lake, or, said the book, was it more reptile-like? We cannot be sure, continues the story, for it appeared to have some of the features of both birds and reptiles. Suddenly, you know, it's getting suspenseful about this time, is all you can stand. The dramatic tale goes on. Our bird-like creature, with its feeble powers of flight, was unable to cope with a sharp gust of wind and fell into the shallow waters below and drowned. Now that's your introduction into bird biology, and then you are told in successive pages of these books that crossbeaks, that the strainer sieve-like beaks of spoon-billed ducks, that the nut-cracking beaks of various parakeets and parrots with their hard, bony-like tongue, as opposed to the long, almost dog or human-like tongue of a duck, of a spoonbill in particular, that spearing beaks, such as herons and kingfishers that actually spear their food, scooping beaks or shovel-like beaks, the lower mandible acting like a scoop shovel in skimming birds like swallows and others that fly low along over a lake or a pond to get insects, that all these different highly developed, specially and technically designed beaks, then all these different kinds of wings, and all of them, remember, acting as propellers as well as stabilizers, so it's a little different than it is with airplanes, that all this evolved. Now, it's an interesting thing that it could have evolved, because, look, let's put it this way. A fuselage can't fly by itself. A propeller doesn't just take off by itself. Wings don't just fly by themselves. The cabin can't fly. You can take the instruments, jerk all that out of an airplane. What do you got left? Well, you got the hull sitting there, but you can't fly it. So you take away from this bird as it's evolving. What does it do? Does it evolve its feathers first? Well, that's fine, but it still can't fly. Because no air sacs, no airframe, no lighter body, no fantastic metabolism, no rapidly beating heart, no greater assimilation of food, and no specially designed muscles, and no rapid nervous system to communicate. No light airframe, no nothing. So it doesn't go, does it? It just doesn't fly. So the idea is that apparently for millions of years, these lizards dragged around over sandy deserts, up and through thorn bushes, and over and under rocks and old rotting stumps and logs, dragging these feathers. Now, obviously, evolution would seem, by its very context, to have told us that instead of growing more feathers, that somebody being hampered by an idiot feather growing out of his left elbow, and here he's trying to crawl between a couple of rocks to conceal himself, but here's his purple feather sticking up. It's the dumbest feeling you can imagine. You'd think that he'd turn around with his beak, if he had a beak, and he'd grab the feather and he'd pluck it out. Now, this article shows you that that might be what you could assume would occur if, that is, you put logic and common sense to play in trying to give evolution a chance to explain itself. Now, if you had a feather that suddenly appeared in the middle of your back, you'd feel kind of dumb about it. I mean, you'd either want to strap it down or cover it up or maybe have it removed electronically. Now, some people, you know, keep trying to remove hair, but the hair keeps growing back. So it seems like whatever was designed to grow there keeps on growing, and I have to shave every morning, and sometimes I hate it. You know, when I go hunting, I try to let it grow about 8 or 10 days just for the sheer joy of not having to hack away at my face with a razor again. But here, you're assured, are these crazy lizards dragging feathers across sandy deserts and up trees for thousands upon thousands of years. All of these millions of them. Now, there had to be far more of them than there were the fully developed species, because the intermediate species would represent a far greater and a vaster segment of the total population of all creatures. Furthermore, since they weren't, as you might say, equipped to survive, for instance, let's put it this way. If the beginning of this bird biology book tells you that Archaeopteryx, which was our bird-like creature with its feeble powers of flight, couldn't even cope with a sharp gust and fell into a lake and drowned, then what about all the millions of his ancestors who not only couldn't cope with a sharp gust, they couldn't even cope with a little tiny gust and couldn't even fly, and they kept leaping to their deaths out of trees and from thorn bushes and off cliffs and the like, and they died by the millions. Why, there would be veritable fossil graveyards of all kinds of half-feathered, partially feathered, finned and scaled and yet feathered creatures that would be intermediate species by the thousands. Common sense tells you so. But the more you look into the ideas of evolution, the more you see they aren't really common sense. When you write for the Plain Truth magazine, you'll see these articles, and now it asks you whether or not such theories are really logical. And it presents them fairly. It doesn't just ridicule one way or the other. It presents them fairly, scientifically, shows you there are answers, that you can discover whether or not there is a God and whether or not that God created mankind and whether or not the intricate design of these creatures means they had to have a designer. Now, if a bird could have developed, let's say, his hollow bones, I know there's a fabulous story in one of them that talks about his hollow bones and how gradually they grew bigger. And still, he didn't have his nervous system, which would be the electronics and all that in an airplane. He still couldn't fly. So in the current number of the Plain Truth magazine is this article on the fable of the first fatal flight, and coming along another one, a theory for the birds. And it will be in full color, illustrated, artist pictures, all kinds of beaks and claws and all kinds of the special apparatus, and then the statements of evolution as to how it possibly evolved, and then the truth about whether or not it could have evolved. That's the place to begin. If you want to know what life is all about, find out where life came from. Write for these booklets, Does God Exist?, the one on the proof of the Bible. Write for the Plain Truth magazine. Be sure to request this booklet on the wonderful world tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It tells you the meaning and the purpose in life as no other booklet can. It's full color, free of charge, no price. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Remember, there is no charge, no cost, no follow-up. No one's going to call on you. The address again in just a moment. Tell us the name of the radio station to which you're listening. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.